Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, October 30th, 2023. Idaho traffic fatalities so far this year exceed the number in 2022. Washington Transportation Department says Western Whitman County trestle destroyed by August wildfire replaced ahead of schedule. EPA awards Idaho Group $770,000 in environmental justice grants. Idaho congressional delegation introduces the Don't Develop Obstructive Infrastructure on Our Terrain Act, which is a response to a proposed giant wind farm in southern Idaho. And we'll have an interview with Zone 3 Moscow School Board candidate Gaylin Clyde. That's all coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman. The Environmental Protection Agency has awarded $435,000 to a Moscow firm for an environmental justice project on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation. The Idaho Capital Sun reports the project on the reservation, which straddles the Idaho-Nevada state line, involves adapting National Incident Management System for emergency response to achieve input on mining. The grant is going to Terra Graphics of Moscow. Another EPA Environmental Justice Project grant is going to the Boise-based Upper Snake River Tribes Foundation. The agency is granting the group $335,000 for its Tribal Youth Environmental Justice and Climate Leadership Program. The grants are part of the federal government's Justice 40 initiative, which seeks to deliver 40% of all federal investments in communities to those that are marginalized, underserved, or overburdened by pollution. EPA Region 10 Administrator Casey Sixkiller wrote in a press release, "Across the Pacific Northwest, our communities can see and feel the impacts of legacy pollution and climate change in their day-to-day lives. These funds are an opportunity for historically underserved areas to advance community-driven solutions that improve public health and the environment." There are more reported details for the $200 million federal investment in tribes' efforts to reintroduce salmon in the Upper Columbia Basin, the Biden administration announced September 21st. The U.S. Department of Energy and the Federal Power Marketing Agency, the Bonneville Power Administration, will distribute $200 million over a 20-year period to assist Upper Columbia United Tribes in their plan to reintroduce salmon upstream of dams which block the fish passage to the Pacific Ocean. The Upper Columbia United Tribes includes the Coeur d'Alene Tribe, the Spokane Tribe of Indians, and the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation. The agreement recognizes historic federal violations against tribes. President Joe Biden signed the announcement of the program last month. The announcement said, "It is a priority of my administration to honor federal trust and treaty responsibilities to tribal nations, including to those tribal nations harmed by the construction and operation of federal dams that are part of the Columbia River system." The Idaho Capital Sun reports the Independent Scientific Advisory Board has estimated before the dams, annual salmon runs in the Upper Columbia Basin were between 10 million and 16 million fish. Spokane Tribal Business Council Chair Greg Abrahamson wrote in a press release, "Grand Coulee Dam allowed the desert to bloom and many faraway cities to enjoy cheap electricity at my people's expense. The tribe never lost hope that one day the salmon would return to the tribe's waters, and this agreement will turn that hope into a reality with salmon in the Spokane's waters. The Spokane tribe believes when the salmon return home, we will begin to heal." The Idaho Capital Sun reports National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration research has found spring run Chinook salmon are the most endangered salmon species on the West Coast. Spring run Chinook and Columbia River steelhead are protected under the Endangered Species Act. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland said at a ceremonial signing, "Today's historic agreement is integral to helping restore healthy and abundant fish populations to these communities. As we work toward comprehensive and collaborative basin-wide solutions to restoring salmon and other native fish populations, the Biden-Harris administration will continue its efforts to honor federal commitments to tribal nations, deliver affordable and reliable clean power, and meet the many resilience needs of stakeholders across the region." You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Spanish-speaking Idahoans face a lack of mental health resources. Advocates in the state want to change that. Curtis Pugh is a mental health manager with the Community Council of Idaho, which serves migrant agricultural laborers and their families. He says there is some stigma surrounding mental health issues in Spanish-speaking communities, but often people in these communities lack access to care.
That's where our biggest obstacles are. There are very few Spanish-speaking mental health professionals, competent Spanish-speaking mental health professionals.
Pugh says access is especially difficult in rural communities, where there might be only one mental health professional, and they aren't likely to speak Spanish. The Community Council of Idaho has partnered with the National Alliance of Mental Illness, or NAMI, Idaho, to help provide resources and family support groups to migrant families in Spanish. In November, NAMI, Idaho is starting a peer support group in Spanish. Jorge Lopez is a board member with the organization and a licensed professional counselor in the state. He uses a variety of methods for connecting with Spanish-speaking folks in the community, such as talking about the shared experience of COVID. Lopez also notes many of those families are immigrants from other countries, which produces its own form of trauma. Because he's from a similar community, he understands what they're going through.
That feeling of being stuck, being lost, being alone, that is associated with mental health. So I kind of use the lived experiences as the bridge to kind of shed light on the fact that, hey, we all struggle with something maybe related to our mental health, our emotions.
Lopez says the most important aspect of expanding services to Spanish speakers is connecting with local groups that are already working in their communities.
The whole point is to always learn the needs from the people themselves, from the community themselves, and not assume what their needs are or assume what the solutions for what they need is.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Idaho Transportation Department reports 222 people have died in traffic accidents in the state so far this year, which is more traffic deaths than in the 12 months of 2022 in the state. Last year's traffic death toll for Idaho was 215. The Lewiston Tribune reports the number of traffic fatalities in north central Idaho, known as Transportation District 2, is 24 so far this year. The breakdown of traffic fatalities by county this year in north central Idaho is 9 in Nez Perce County, 9 in Idaho County, 4 in Clearwater County, 2 in Latah County, and 0 in Lewis County. The Idaho Office of Highway Safety reports 74 of the 222 people who died in traffic accidents in the state this year were not wearing safety belts. Safety belts increase the odds of surviving a crash by 50%. Of the traffic deaths in Idaho so far this year, 67 were from single-vehicle crashes, not including the 18 who died in single motorcycle accidents. Of the traffic deaths so far this year, 152 were drivers or passengers of motor vehicles, 37 were on motorcycles, 25 were pedestrians, 4 were on bicycles, and 4 were on some other type of vehicle, such as an all-terrain vehicle. Washington Transportation Department Communications Manager Janet Matkin says workers have finished replacing the Palouse River Coulee City Railroad's Hooper Bridge near Winona in western Whitman County ahead of schedule, and trains carrying grain are now going over the bridge. Workers replaced the 197-foot wooden bridge, which burned in a wildfire August 18th, with a 210-foot steel and concrete bridge, which Matkin says, is more durable than the wooden trestle was. Transportation officials expected the bridge to be completed by early next month. Matkin told the Lewiston Tribune the bridge replacement job is under budget. Transportation officials estimated it would cost almost $2.8 million to replace, but the final cost is just below $2.5 million. The August 18th wildfire burned 2,500 acres of mostly cropland and destroyed one home and destroyed or damaged 24 outbuildings. The bridge at Winona is an important link for crops being sent to mainline railroads along the Columbia River. During much of this year's harvest, grain that growers would normally ship by rail to downriver markets had to be shipped by truck. The Lewiston Tribune reported the Palouse River Coulee City Short Line Railroad handles up to 2,600 railroad cars of grain and produce per year. The bridge replacement involved the company Watco, which operates the portion of the line where the bridge is located, who contracted with Cramer North America to build the new bridge. The railroad needed permits from Whitman County, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the Washington Department of Natural Resources for the construction to move forward. Matkin told the paper, the fact that all parties worked together so well made it all come together beautifully. It was a matter of speedy expedition for all the permitting and necessary inspections, acquisition of materials, and a very experienced bridge building team to finish ahead of schedule.
When the Postal Service works better, people are more likely to vote, according to new research. The study published in the Election Law Journal finds efficient postal service increases voter turnout regardless of a state's mail voting laws. Some states have passed more restrictive mail-in voting laws since the false accusations of voter fraud in the 2020 election. Author of the research, Michael Ritter, at Washington State University, says the link is strong between good mail service and voting probability.
Which indicates that the postal system is a critical factor in structuring the ability of mail voting to promote higher voter turnout at the individual level in the country.
Ritter says mail speed can determine whether a ballot makes it to an election office in time to be counted. During the 2023 session, Idaho lawmakers attempted to make it harder to vote by mail with restrictions on absentee ballots, but the bill died in the House. There was talk of reduced postal service in the run-up to the 2020 election, which may have hurt confidence among some potential voters that their ballot would be delivered in time to be counted. Ritter says that underscores the importance of mail service in elections.
Does the postal system have sufficient resources to be able to reliably administer mail voting? I think that's an important factor.
Ritter says the connection between mail service and voter turnout remains a critical issue.
What I find in my article, that the postal system matters in moderating the impact of mail voting, will continue to be the case in subsequent elections in the future, including 2024.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by SkyGlow Solar, offering solar power systems installations on the Palouse and surrounding region. Information at skyglowsolar.com or contact Brian Ogle at 208-310-4545.
For the first time in more than a decade, Washington residents won't see advisory votes on their ballots in this year's elections. Advisory votes asked people if they approved of tax laws passed by the legislature, although the results had no impact on the tax laws themselves. Critics argued that they cluttered ballots, making them harder to understand. During the 2023 session, lawmakers agreed, nixing advisory votes completely from future elections. Haley Wu with the Asian Counseling and Referral Service says she saw people struggle with these non-binding votes in the past.
For some people, if it's their first time voting, it kind of creates a challenge for them. It kind of decreases their enthusiasm on voting. It really creates a barrier for those people who don't speak the language.
Advisory votes were established as part of a ballot initiative passed in 2007. Lawmakers in support of the advisory votes argued because of that, it should have been up to voters whether to get rid of them. The repeal of advisory votes is expected to save counties millions of dollars. According to an analysis of the 2017 election by the Northwest Progressive Institute, advisory votes cost counties more than $2.7 million in total. Head of the Institute, Andrew Villeneuve, says the wording of the votes was also misleading, because it didn't mention where the taxes you were advising on would be invested.
It asked you if you wanted to repeal it or maintain it. Well, no matter how you voted, nothing was going to happen. So it was a false choice. I mean, people are being asked to weigh in on something that didn't actually have any merit or bearing on anything.
In place of votes on tax laws, Villeneuve says the state has set up an online fiscal dashboard.
Our listing of bills that raise revenue is actually more comprehensive than what people were seeing on their ballots, which was not fair or neutrally worded.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The four Republicans in the Idaho congressional delegation have introduced the Don't Do It Act, also known as the Don't Develop Obstructive Infrastructure on Our Terrain Act, that would require the U.S. Interior Secretary to deny any wind or solar project on public land that the state legislature in the affected state votes against. Senators Jim Risch and Mike Crapo, along with U.S. Representatives Mike Simpson and Russ Fulcher, cite local opposition to the proposed Lava Ridge Wind Project that would place 400 wind turbines up to 740 feet tall, 25 miles northeast of Twin Falls. The turbines would require a network of new roads, power lines, and substations across Jerome, Lincoln, and Minidoka counties. Idaho Governor Brad Little signed his name to a joint letter with the congressional delegation, which said affected farmers, ranchers, tribes, the Japanese American community, and sportsmen have voiced legitimate objections. As it stands today, the local community predominantly has not shown support for this development. The letter said the wind facility would conflict with deep-rooted Idaho values of land use for recreation and grazing. The nonprofit Friends of Minidoka, which preserves the Minidoka Historic Site that was the location of a concentration camp for Japanese Americans during World War II, also opposes the project. We now have another in our six interviews with Moscow school board candidates, an interview with Zone 3 candidate Gay Lynn Clyde. Clyde is running against the incumbent Dulcy Kirsting Lark, who was appointed to the school board in December. Zone 3 includes part of the south section of Moscow east of Main Street, plus a large rural section south, southeast, and east of the city extending to Ede Road and Blaine to the south, two-thirds of the way to Troy to the east, and to Robinson Park Road to the north. In the other two races, incumbent Jim Frenzel is facing a challenge from Cody Barr in Zone 1, and incumbent Don Fazio is facing a challenge from Jim Gray in Zone 4. Galen Clyde is a mother of two children who have gone through the Moscow School District system and was active in reintroduction of Future Farmers of America programs at Moscow High School 4 years ago. I spoke to Clyde Friday afternoon.
In your opinion, how successful has the Moscow School District been in educating students in the last few years?
Excellent. So I think Moscow High School was just ranked 173, I believe, out of the nation, which is amazing. I think we're ranked 30th in the state. You know, Moscow School District has an excellent reputation for excellence in education.
And those rankings, what are they based on?
I believe they're based on SAT scores, so standardized testing and GPA, and I think furtherment into how many kids are going on into higher education, how many graduation rates, and things like that.
Okay. One thing I haven't talked about in the interviews so far with Moscow School District candidates is employee retention, but you've mentioned that in some of your candidacy materials. And I guess the first question in my mind is, does the school board set salaries for employees, or is that something the superintendent deals with?
You know, to be honest with you, I'm not sure who sets the salaries for teachers, paraprofessionals, support staff. But I'm the school board has an integral part of supporting the superintendent. So if that were the case, the superintendent was the one that would decide that, then the school board, as a school board member, I would fully support helping to, have living wages for people. I think some of the retention issues, again, is maybe not necessarily salary, because you can look at, so I'll give you an example. So bus drivers. We have a heck of a time keeping and retaining bus drivers, and our salaries are pretty good. If you look at what they're offering, I believe it was $22 an hour. And don't quote me on that, but it looked like it was pretty good. So I don't necessarily know that salary is definitely the final variable in terms of hiring and retaining. I think some of it is salary, but some of it is stress. I think that we're giving people tasks that are not doable. So I've said that many a times. We need to make jobs doable for people. So we can't have our paraprofessionals having too many students working too many hours. We can't have our bus drivers being asked to have lots of routes that may be very difficult to drive. Again, these are just from my perspective and talking to a few other people that have tried to bus drive. If you've driven a car down some of Moscow's roads, it's tight, and driving a bus is even more tight. So if we can make our jobs more doable, then I think we can try to help our support staff with retention.
Is part of the reason the job of bus driver is so stressful is because of understaffing, like they have to take extra routes? Or
yeah, I know that they have a hard time retaining bus drivers. So, and the other issue that I've heard is there's, because we're having fewer bus drivers, we're having to have more kids on the bus. So the buses are very, very full of kids. And so I think that's stressful for the bus drivers. And so, again, if we can fill those positions, again, I don't know this for sure. This is just me empathizing, is to have maybe smaller buses. I don't know if that's even a possibility. But again, our roads downtown are extremely difficult to get around in. I think, if we're able to build infrastructure farther out where maybe people don't have to be unloading and loading in very busy downtown areas, that might be helpful as well.
What are your thoughts about the Idaho Freedom Foundation and their efforts to defund public education, and how might that affect K through 12?
So I'm unfamiliar with the Idaho
Freedom Foundation.
I can't say that. I believe the legislation just met, and there was a news article on that in terms of voucher systems and other avenues for people to get money for their kids to not be in public schools. And so far, it looks to me that like the legislature is not supporting that. So again, as a school board, potential school board member, I think it's important to understand that board members need to follow the laws of the state of Idaho. So if the state of Idaho has a law on the books, so they either will support something or not support something, it's not up to the school board to make legislation. It's up to the school board to implement what the laws are on the books.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I wanted to clarify, the Idaho Freedom Foundation actually has quite a bit of clout in the legislature right now. They may not have complete control, but they basically make claims that Idaho teachers are indoctrinating students in social justice, equity, and critical race theory, which they see as bad things. Any opinions on that?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's see. You mentioned during the candidates forum that you wanted to make sure that the school district follows House Bill 163, and I looked that up. It just passed this year. It requires school districts to write a policy that outlines standards for selecting and accessing school library materials, including how materials will be shelved and labeled by age group or grade level, a process for district parents and guardians to challenge materials, and a process for parents and guardians to restrict their child's access to materials. The bill requires school districts to give reasonable access, in quotes, for parents to visit a school, and it prohibits school libraries from having materials that are, quote, harmful to minors, which that law defines as pictures, image, graphic image, file, or other visual depictions that appeal to prurient interest in nudity, sex, or excretion, and so forth. It's further defined. And each school board in the state must introduce a policy during an open public meeting and give patrons 30 days to share testimony and written comment on it. So I want to ask about that law in general, and what parts of it you see important, and maybe are there parts that are problematic? I mean, it just passed.
Sure. Yeah, so House Bill 163 did just pass this last July, and it is called the Parental Rights Bill. It is one of the things that I have as one of my platform items as a school board member. I do feel like it is important that it's a joint effort. Educating children is a joint effort between parents and teachers and administration and community. So it's all a joint effort. And so what I think the Parental Rights Act is doing, again, when you say things need to be reasonable, I totally agree that the district, teachers, administration need to work with parents to develop a system in which parents can have access, or if they choose to have access to educational materials, if they want to come into the class, if they want to see I guess I see this as, from a scientific point of view, the best disinfectant is light. And so if you bring light into something, if you increase communication, again, I work in an industry that communication is overly important. You over-communicate, you disclose, you try to do as much as you can within reason. So again, we're not trying to create so much burden for teachers and administration that they can't teach the kids. This will be a process. This isn't just like create a website type thing. This will be a process over a long period of time in which parents can have access to learning materials. They can have a process at which if they don't agree with something, then they can remove their children from that learning process. I think that in general, the policy is very good. I think it has good intentions. But devil's in the detail, right? Anytime that you administer, you make something in terms of a policy, and then you try to make that policy rules and regulations that involve that, then you get into the details that become very problematic in terms of implementation. So it's so new. Moscow hasn't rolled this out yet. I think we need to try to move in that direction in terms of providing parents with more light on what their children are being taught. I think go back to the previous question that you were talking about with the Idaho Freedom Foundation. Yeah. And that there's some people that feel like kids are being indoctrinated and et cetera. And the more that we can shed light on what is being taught to the kids, then that is the perfect rebuttal to that, right? In terms of that's not really happening. So the more that we can share with our parents and make it reasonable for our district and our teachers to provide them, we can't just throw this out to the teachers and say, make this happen. There's got to be administrative support coming down to give the teachers tools to make this happen. And so I think part of your question was, do I see any problems with it? And what I see is rolling it out correctly with a lot of thought in mind. You can't just roll something out this huge without having a lot of pre-planning in place for it.
Yeah, and I haven't read the entire text of the new law. I'm wondering if you know what it says about parents or guardians, attending classes and how often or repeatedly or so forth.
Yeah, so the bill does as an example, talks about parents coming into the class, but does not give any parameters on how to implement that. Those types of things are going to be implemented at the school level. So again, go back to the quote that says, within reason, with and reasonably accommodated. If it's going to disrupt the classroom, if it is going to affect learning, when you have, you know, parents coming in every single day, and they have labs and things like that that would disturb it, that is not protected, as far as I understand, by the House bill.
Okay. And it will probably be up to the school board to, you know, make sure that these are implemented, or determine a way to implement this law. Yes. Even more than the teachers and the administrators, or at least you guys are going to provide oversight if you get elected.
Yeah, yeah. I see this as a holistic input type. I'll go back to the job that I'm in. We have to have input from all stakeholders before, before anything can be implemented. You need to hear from all of your stakeholders. So again, parents, teachers, administration, how can we make this doable? I come back to the word doable. And in a way that is not going to be overly burdensome for teachers, but we give parents that tool to help understand what how their children are being educated.
All right. And I want to stick on the school libraries and book bannings, because there is a national movement, Moms for Liberty, and also, you know, in Florida, there's a lot of parallels in Idaho to Ron DeSantis's way of dealing with the educational system. And basically, there are claims of grooming students with books in the school libraries or in public libraries and so forth. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about that issue that seems to have exploded in the last year or so.
Sure. So, again, from a perspective of a school board member, I will go back to the fact that you need to follow state law. So I'm going to give you a couple Idaho codes, which is 18-15-4. And 18-15-13 and 18-14 describes Idaho policy on it defines what obscene is, and then the policy 15-13 describes the distribution of obscene material to minors. So I think both of those are ones that probably your listeners should go back and look at. It defines what obscene materials are. It also describes the distribution of that to minors. And as a school board member, again, if we have something on the books in terms of law, I think it is important for school board members to support those. And then also goes back to HB 163, which is what we just got through talking about, is the parental rights bill in terms of knowing what materials, which includes library materials, that their children have access to.
And, of course, the issue, I think, for a lot of people is that some of the people that are coming to school board meetings around Idaho trying to keep books out of the school libraries or going to library board meetings are casting a wide net and having books banned that might actually validate students who are otherwise ostracized or bullied because they might be gay or trans kids. And there's the argument that a kid that's ostracized or marginalized like that, who reads a book that validates their who they are, could save their life, because we know that suicide rates are very high among LGBTQ and trans youth. And so I wanted to bring up that argument that goes along with the various laws and efforts to ban books. So do you have any comments on that particular point of view?
Sure. Are using words such as banning books to get people hyped up about this? What I think the overall agenda of this is that we are required to follow the law. And if there are knowing materials in our school libraries that are obscene, and that is defined by Idaho state law, parents need to know about that, which is HB 163. And again, we can go back to, you know, how do we let people know that those types of things there? So maybe we could create some sort of a rating system, just like a movie theater, right? We have R-rated movies, we have PG-13, we have PG, we have G-rated movies. And, you know, those books could be rated. There are many rating systems out there for books. And parents can say, okay, well, my 14-year-old can only have access to rated books of 1 or 2. My 18-year-old could have access to a 5. One way of kind of addressing that, so that we can potentially not distribute obscene material to a child that's under 18, but still provide what you were talking about, that maybe there are some children that, or adults at 18, that would, or their parents would allow them to see that, would have access to that type of material.
That was our interview with Zone 3 Moscow School Board candidate Galen Clyde. Clyde is running against incumbent Dulcy Kirsting Lark. The interview was edited for length. You can hear the entire interview with Galen Clyde, along with our interview with her opponent, Dulcy Kirsting Lark, by going to the Friday, October 27th edition of the KRFP Evening Report on the KRFP website. All 3 school board seats up for election this year are contested in the Moscow School District. Zone 3 includes part of the south section of Moscow, east of Main Street, plus a large rural section south, southeast, and east of the city, extending to Ede Road and Blaine to the south, two-thirds of the way to Troy to the east, and to Robinson Park Road to the north. In the other 2 races, incumbent Jim Frenzel is facing a challenge from Cody Barr in Zone 1, and incumbent Don Fazio is facing a challenge from Jim Gray in Zone 4. The winners in the November 7th school board election will serve on the board with trustees Ken Fonts from Zone 2 and Brian Kennedy from Zone 5. Fonts and Kennedy have 2 years remaining in their terms. We have interviews with all 6 of the candidates running in this year's Moscow school board elections on the KRFP website. Go to the Friday, October 27th edition of the KRFP Evening Report. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly clear tonight, low 25. Increasing clouds, high 50 on Tuesday. Mostly cloudy, low 29 Tuesday night. Mostly sunny Wednesday, high 51. 60% chance of rain Wednesday night, mainly after midnight. Mostly cloudy, low 35. And Thursday, 90% chance of rain, high 49. Currently 37 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Go to the KRFP.org website to find out more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. Flashpoints is up next, followed by Zach Dunoir playing music for you 7:30 to 9. And Chia Pets on to play music for you 9 to 11 tonight, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Syndicated world music with the Motherland Influence. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by Hunga Dunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Hunga Dunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram. KRFP programming is also sponsored by
Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as Euros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.